Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Prep Talk podcast hosted by myself, Pete Flips, and at Nick Spizak. Today, we have a very special guest, Jeff, a $25 million per year OA seller. He does a dash of wholesale. He's created a team around him that has stateside and has recently become active in social media. So, Jeff, welcome onto the podcast. We're very happy to have you here.
Yeah, nice to actually virtually meet you guys.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, $25 million. That's a wild number. Everybody says like you're capped around what, like 2-3 million?
Yeah, it's usually what they say.
That's what they say. So can you dive a little bit into the backstory of how it all started, and then we'll walk into kind of the current operation?
Okay. I was working a 9-to-5, right. You know, living the dream, leaving my house at 7 a.m., coming home at 7 o'clock at night. barely seeing my, I had one kid at that point. My wife was 9 months pregnant. And said, why don't I start a business? And really what I was into like travel hacking and, you know, sort of discovered it from that. So then I started like probably pretty much anybody. I was like, okay, I did a little RA, but I mostly started with OA, and I actually started with Amazon Flips, you know, pretty early on. So I started with, you know, Flips and some OA and some RA, and I quickly decided RA is not for me, especially, you know, working 7-to-7. And I was really trying to avoid, you know, working too much on the weekend and spending time with the family. So right. I mostly just got home at 7, put the kids to bed at 9, and then worked and just started dabbling with OA. I think after the first shipment, I said, this sucks. And, you know, looking through prep center, especially because the math just makes sense from a prep center, right?
Oh, like, yeah,
you know, just, you know, there's not much sense of prepping in-house. If you're buying stuff, you're going to pay tax in anyway. If you're in a tax-free state or buying a bunch of tax exempt, that's a different story. But so I quickly switched to your prep center and just, you know, I grinded out for 2 years of just, you know, I mean, I didn't do numbers like some of you crazy guys start out with, you know, six figures after, you know, a few months. But, you know, my second Q4, I did, I think, 125 in December, like, you know, not. To me, that was fantastic. Awesome. You know, I mean, this was 9 years ago. So
that's
really
yeah.
So
the game was different.
Yeah. So about my 2 year mark, I said it's time to make the move and quit the job. And went full time. That Q4, I set a goal of doing 1 million in Q4. I think we hit like 1.1. It was just mostly me out of the garage. I still was doing all the you know, shipping and I had two people helping that were helping prep. And then I eventually had one of those people say, okay, I'm going to build you a buy list. Go pick up stuff at Toys R Us of, you know, back when that was a
damn, thing. You're dating yourself.
Yes, I know. I'm old. I said, I've been doing this for 9 years. I did 1 million Q4. Then I was like, okay, I've outgrown my garage and moved into, you know, 2,500 square foot warehouse. And we really just doubled. Like, you know, we did, I think, 1.7 that year. We did about 4 the next. Then we did 8. And then COVID hit. And, you know, we went from 8 to, I think, like 22 or 23. And then, you know, then the next year we did 26.5. 25 comes up, I guess, because it's a nice round number. But
yeah,
you know, yeah. 26.5 the next year. And then, you know, we've sort of been grinding out around that area. Right around that time, I also shifted a little bit. You know, diversification is something that, you know, comes up a lot as you're, you know, doing this, right? Like all your eggs are in Amazon basket. And it's a little scary, right? Like, you know, they hold your fate, you know, and you can try to diversify and sell on Walmart and your own things, but it's not, it's hard. Like Amazon's where it's at. That's where all the people go. So, finally I got to the point when I was, you know, doing some big numbers, I was like, let's take some, you know, cash out and let's, you know, start a real estate business. So I bought 10 rental properties in 18 months. If you've ever closed on a house, can you imagine trying doing that 10 times in an 18 month period while at the same time, you know, running an 8-figure Amazon business? But that seemed like a good idea. At the same time, you mentioned early on, I'm new to social media. At the same time, I had a 20,000 member Facebook group, because again, I'm old. So, you know, I'm not really new to social media. Yeah. I ran a, you know, a social media Amazon group, you know, that was up to like 20,000 members. So I eventually sold that because I was like, I can't do all these at the same time, and took a little break from social media. And then that's where we've been sort of. We've stopped purchasing properties right now with the rates at like 7 or 8%, and yep. also just trying to scale that one a little quickly with so many purchases in so quick of time. So we're focusing on, you know, fixing up the places, and we're all short-term rentals, so they're Airbnb and VRBO, and we're working on getting our own website going, and what's the word I'm looking for? Get some of that off of Airbnb. So again, that we have a little bit of that diversification. Because here I am, I created another business, and it's again relying on another mammoth company that holds my fate. But at least we have VRBO as a backup, and we're going to get our own site going. So
nice.
That's what we've been doing.
So one thing that I think would be valuable for the audience is kind of the context and the blood and the sweat that went into like $1 million out of your garage in a month.
Yes.
What was that like going
through? Yeah, I mean, that still, I think, is one of the most impressive things that we accomplished was, that. Yeah, I mean, we did some crazy things because, we did, in COVID, we were working out of a 2,500 square foot warehouse with, not that many employees. And we did whatever, 22, 23 million that time. But yeah, I mean, that was a lot because I still was doing everything. Like I still was the only one listing anything. So I was listing everything. And I mean, obviously we had the prep center and center. And at that point I might have two or three prep centers, but we were doing a lot because, again, dating myself, but back in the day you used to have this thing called premium placement. So we would buy everything. We'd pay an extra. It was almost like $1 a unit, I think, but we would send it to fulfillment centers instead of distribution centers. So instead of sending it to your fulfillment center, then sends it out to all the distribution center or to the fulfillment centers, we would send right to the fulfillment center and things would be live right away. So we would, shop or order stuff, fill up a truck. At that point, we're still just doing UPS, fill up the truck. And within 12 hours, half of it would be sold half the time because it would check in quickly with premium placement and would sell. It's almost like, the people that talk about MF, it was sort of like MF without actually having to MF all those things. You just shipped it in. So we were just, and back then I was, we would slaughter Target, I know it was, they were not reseller friendly at that point, I guess, but we still would get a lot of orders in. And then I had one person out that wasn't a shopper at that point. They were just, buying for me, like I'd give them a list and she'd run out and buy all the stuff and fill up her truck, I'd come back and then she'd prep. I had a little office in the, like an area that I worked in the garage, because after our first Q4, we finished the garage. We put some flooring down, we put a heater AC unit in, put some insulation. And I don't know how many times I just fall asleep in the garage just, working until I couldn't anymore. I mean, it was a lot of work, but we quickly, grew it from there and said, okay, I got to get the heck out of the garage. And that's when we moved into our first warehouse.
Nice. Jeff, you have a ton of experience over the last 9 years. Can you talk a little bit about how the game's changed from when you started till now? Like you hit on an angle of Target. What is the dynamic look like? What are the ebbs and flows? Like, walk us through. Like,
yeah,
I mean, we're Amazon sellers at this stage of the game. What did we miss?
You missed a Nike listings with 10 people on it, 20 people on it. we used to complain back in those Q4s, there's 50 sellers on a hot toy. Now in Q4 there's 450 sellers on a hot toy. And heck, you could actually make money with hot toys. Suppressed buy boxes weren't as bad. They were starting, but not as bad as they are now, where like anything that dips over MSRP, especially in Q4, tends to go off of it. And in general, it's just one thing you always have to do is be able to adapt. Like, we've shifted so many times in this business, and that's part of the reason I feel like we've been somewhat successful. I sort of glossed over it, but when I first got out of the garage and started the warehouse, I was RA. Like I had a team of I had three shoppers in my the Philly area. Then I started to hire people shit, it's getting saturated. They're going to start fighting. How do I expand? So then I started hiring people 90 minutes away that could source and then drop off. So then, at some point I'm like, okay, well, there's only so many of these people that I can hire. So then I started, hiring people throughout the East Coast around outlets that had unique stuff. So everybody knows about Nike factory stores, but Nike clearance stores can be really good. Hurley clearance, different stores that you can't find everywhere that has, good inventory. So I had somebody in Delaware. I had somebody in Maryland. I had somebody in Georgia, Tennessee, Orlando. I had all these people around, and then COVID hit. And I was like, shit, what am I going to do? I got nine, you know, RA shoppers and all the stores are closed. So now that being said, I was always OA. So I would OA. And you know, at that point, our business was a third of everything. I pretty much, I did all the OA, and I just started to shift my best shopper into OA slash supervising this massive RA team I had built and wholesale. And I've, you know, it all was like done like that. So we quickly shifted people in, you know, in-house to OA. I said, look, guys, we don't know what the hell's going on with, you know, COVID. You know, I know there's some money to be out there with getting into some of the stores you can, but we're just going to, you know, pull it in-house and do OA. So we switched. Yeah, and so we were an $8 million business at that point, you know, with, you know, primary focus on RA, just switched to OA. And that year we did, you know, what was that, like $22 million. I would say 85% of it was Nike shoes, or at least Nike. Yeah, 85% was Nike. Christmas Eve, I got an email, brand review on Nike, brand review on Converse. Inventory not, and no warning, just inventory stranded. Now you know, so I had, you know, I had almost $1 million of inventory at that point stranded, you know, on Christmas Eve. So it sort of made me think, okay, I need to diversify a little bit, maybe not 85% of my money in Nike. So, you know, it took a couple weeks to get it all cleared up or whatever, and Converse, and then we really started to focus on, okay, let's not just do Nike. Let's, you know, do some other brands. And I think I looked at her dad. I don't even think Nike's 5% of our business anymore. Like, we just, you know, we've diversified, you know, to other brands, and, you know, just, it's, you just have to keep adapting, because this thing changes quickly. And if not, you will not keep up.
Yeah. I think that's kind of like a hot topic right now, obviously, with some of the restrictions on Nike and such. But like, I think that people that find themselves in this space tend to be like more risk oriented, and it's almost like if you have a hammer, use it.
Yeah.
But how did you like make that shift? You got your 85%, and like, how did you like come off of that and like just push yourself into learning all of these new brands and all that?
Yeah, no. I mean, one of the things that I tend to do is at that point I started to try to hire people to focus on other areas. So at that point we had shoes and clothes shoppers, and, you know, again, we shifted all those people in, and they were focused on shoes and clothes and a lot of Nike. And in particular too, like, you know, I can say it now cause it's not a great source anymore, but it was mostly Rack Room and Famous Footwear. Like, we were just hammering those stores around. I would say probably my team's a good reason you can't get more than 25 orders in a month anymore. But, you know, so even beyond that, we had to shift our sourcing, because you couldn't spend $500,000 on Rack Room in a week anymore, because they just didn't want my money anymore. We just had to find other sources, other brands. And on top of that, again, I hired, even at that point, I said, okay, yes, we're hitting eight figures, but we need to start trying to diversify and go into other, you know, brands. So I'd hire somebody and say, okay, look, you're not allowed to buy shoes and clothes. You can come work for us, but you're not allowed to buy shoes and clothes. You can't buy Nike. And we just sort of forced people to source other avenues and whatnot. And that's really, it's also how I learn. Like, there's always that risk if you hire somebody, they're going to steal your business model and try to, you know, take it or whatever. Like, anytime you talk about hiring shoppers, I'm like, I'm not really going to teach them much. They're going to get a very bit, and then they're going to teach me, because they're going to teach me new stores, because I don't know how to source this category. You need to teach me. I'll teach you, you know, aspects, and you'll have access to my capital, you know, as we purchase, you know, from a shopper standpoint. But you're going to teach me how to source a new category, or you're going to be out of here.
So you kind of put delegation on its head a little bit, where you're saying you're almost hiring partners that you're giving a salary. And or however you structure it, but like, did delegation just come naturally, or is that something that you learned? I feel like our audience is in that beginner phase.
Yeah. Oh no, I was horrible. I tried to do everything myself, but at some point, again, this obviously, you know, this was, I forget what year four or year five when I finally, you know, again, we were, you know, doubling pretty much every year. But it was a lot of like me doing it. And it just, you get to a point that there's only so much I have time. And that, I mean, that's really what broke me was, okay, like I can't expand if I'm the one doing the prep, the shipping, and the operations side. So that's where I sort of forced myself to delegate. But it was hard, I said that first year when we did 1.1 in the out of the garage, I listed every item, because I think at that point I still had to like list for the prep center. I was listing there and I was just, and finally, I started to hire people when we moved into the warehouse and starting to train that off. And then, it took me until, that 2019 year where we did 8 million. It wasn't until I think halfway through that year, I finally said, okay, I need somebody to like help on the back end because you scale up, like trying to manage dealing with customers, dealing with Amazon. And then, so we had that massive buy team and I used to gather all their data and I was still doing all the damn like listing and stuff. And I finally said, okay, I need to hire like an operations person to manage all that. So it was almost forced. The first time I hired a prep person was, our second Q4, I came home and I'm like, what the hell am I doing? There's packages everywhere. I'm like, I'm never going to get this out. So I put something on Facebook that day. I said, who wants to come work? Like I sort of go to, I can't anymore. And then I finally delegate.
Yeah. I think that that's also a theme is that like the business owners will back themselves into a corner until it's literally painful. And then finally I'll do it. Like, the destination is pretty heavy in this space. But if you do those actions enough times, if you outsource these small tasks over and over, it begins to compound in a way that you really can't appreciate until you've already done it.
Yeah. No, and that was the key pre-COVID. I was like, we had hit 8 million and we starting to do very well. And I'm like, I can't keep at this pace of like working so much. Like I quit my day job so I could see my family. And my wife's like, I thought you were going to work less. And I'm like, well, I have more time freedom. It does, you want me to go, do something in the middle of the day. I can do it now. Look, so that's where so I took my three best people and I created like what I called my leadership team. And I said, you're the head of the warehouse. You're head of the operations. You're the head of your purchasing shopping team. You guys are going to get, bonus based on the profitability of the company. Go build and manage your departments so I can have some more time. Of course, then I decided, well, I got so much time. Let's start buying real estate and start another company because I'm not good at, sitting still. But, that was sort of the intention of, okay, let them really run with it. And COVID obviously was a big, catalyst to the growth, but putting that leadership team in place, motivating them with the correct compensation. And of course, COVID minimizing what everybody could do. It's like, well, might as well just work. I think helped. And, it just was obviously a good opportunity.
So you're someone that has literally bootstrapped your company from the ground up, first million plus. Now you're into a position where you're starting to make money work for you. You're building your team, you're setting goals, you're starting to think through that. And you have stateside employees that are part of it, right? So walk us through a little bit for the rest of the audience. What did that journey look like? I'm sure that was not an overnight thing. So walk us from like where you were at and how you came to those like milestones of realizations, like, hey, I need to build a team and this is how I'm going to motivate them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It's just one of the things that, again, I come up like overnight. I'm like, okay, the whole RA thing, right? Like I just hiring people and I'm like, well, how am I going to expand? Oh, let's hire people here. So I just sort of like come up with these crazy ideas and then implement them and then sort of back my way into how it's supposed to be done. Cause we had the local people and I was like, okay, how am I going to grow this even more? Let's take my best shopper, we'll make her supervisor. And hey, I'm going to hire like six shoppers and we'll hope they work out. Like, and it's probably wasn't the wisest idea to hire six people at the same time. And I'm like, well, at least we only have to train them once. So let's just, get them all going at the same time. And I'm always like, I'm a numbers guy. I was, in my you know, I was an accountant. I mean, I had a CPA. I don't know if I really worked in it, but anyway, I'm a numbers guy. I've always been a numbers guy. So I'm always like running numbers and then trying to back my way into, okay, how do I get there? How do I do that? What needs to be done to reach those goals? And then, you know, try to figure it out. And, you know, I failed many times. I mean, the RA side, yeah, we switched because of COVID, but we weren't crushing it with RA. It was a pain in the ass, you know, managing, you know, all those shoppers remotely and having them ship back to the warehouse. And, you know, it was almost, COVID almost pushed us in the right direction versus me being wise and saying, okay, let's do OA, you know. And I mean, I've hired and fired probably over 50 shoppers. Like, you know, it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of, you know, trying to figure things out and fumbling and, you know, eventually getting there.
There was something you mentioned earlier. I want to hit on it, right? So you were talking about how you were able to raise capital. You're like, hey, we're starting to do 22, 23, 25 million now for an entire year. That's not small numbers, right? So how have you built up that capital over time? Like, that you're averaging 2 million plus a month with those numbers. How do you make that happen? Like, for the Amazon seller that's starting to think through, like, hey, is this even attainable? Like, walk us through that journey.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. One, obviously, as I said, doubling, I didn't go from like 4 to 24. It was like, you know, 2, 4, 8, then it went a little nuts to, 22 or whatever. But, it was mostly somewhat slow growth. But in between that slow growth, trying to get credit was almost a full-time job. So, when I first started to grow a little bit, I went out and got a line of credit, you know, and it was like 80,000 from TD Bank or whatever. It's, you know, somewhat regional bank, and it was easy to get. It was, you know, I had to provide like tax returns and financials, but not too bad. And then I was like, okay, like, look, especially because my business, you know, we do, last times in Q4, we do more than the other 9 months of the year. Like, we just, you know, we do a massive, you know, we do usually do 8 figures in Q4 alone. So that's where it gets difficult, because we're going from, you know, spending 750 to a million a month to trying to spend 3 million, you know, in you know, a couple, you know, a 3 week period or whatever. So that's where I was like, I really need access to more capital. And so I went back to the bank and I said, hey, I need, you know, line of credit, you know, can we talk more like 200,000, 300,000? They're like, well, once you get over 100, you're out of the small business and you now go to commercial, let me pass you to that. And then they like wouldn't give me the time of day. And they're like, you know, we'll try, but I don't know, what's this Amazon thing? And so I could tell that wasn't working. So I went to two other banks. And at the same time, I'm like applying to three different banks, trying to get, you know, and at this point it was like summer. I think it was like summer. It was at the point where I was very inventory heavy. So they're like, you have no money. I'm like, well, no shit. That's why I'm here with you. I want some money. Well, give you money. I'm like, well, what? So they're like, come back in January when you actually have money. So I was like, okay. So then I come back in January. They all rejected me and said, no, we can't give you, you know, we can give you 100K. I'm like, I already got 100K. I need 300K. So I took an Amazon, for what it's worth, I took an Amazon loan. I think that, because Amazon at that point was pretty, you know, easy to get, you know, money. But at that point, they didn't have a line of credit. So it was a loan. So line of credits are nice because you can tap in and out and shift, and also a little lower rates than Amazon. But I think I took a couple $100,000 loan from Amazon, used that to help have a good Q4, sold boatloads of stuff, got lots of cash. And I'm like, boom, now they're going to give me money because, one, I have another good year behind me and I have all this cash. I can show them the cash. So I go in, I go same song and dance with multiple banks. You have no inventory. You're too cash heavy. I'm like, what the hell? Nobody's making money. And, you know, ironically, there's this like small little bank that I worked in high school down the street from me. And I drove past it every day looking for money. And finally, I like, well, I guess I'll stop in there. And they're like, how much do you need? I'm like, 350. Like, okay, no problem. I'm like, sure, no problem. And, you know, like, you know, six, you know, a month or two later, boom, I got 350 line of credit. And I'm like, God, I'm driving past this bank every freaking day. It's a mile from my house, going to all these like larger banks. And I started calling credit unions, and you know, it was a pain. So I mean, that's just from getting access to, you know, like a line of credit. Then on top of that, you know, from a wholesale perspective, you know, trying to get some terms with suppliers. And it's the same song and dance. Like, hey, I want to get, terms with you. Where's your reference? Well, how can I get a reference if nobody's going to give me money? So, but you have to sign all the, negotiating with people of like, hey, look, what do you need from me? I'll give you a tax return. And eventually you start like bribing some of my suppliers. Like, look, I don't even care. I will pay you on day one. I just need to use a damn reference so that I can get another line of credit. So what do you need me to do so that I can put your name on a piece of paper? So, like, get a reference. So that's what I like started to do, was just like, try to convince these guys, like, hey, I can pay you more money. Just tell me. I just need to have a damn reference so that I can get one. And then, once you started negotiating, they give me a little bit. The next, start to get some six-figure lines of credits with, some of our, suppliers that we're doing bigger orders in. So that helped. And then the last one, of course, is the credit cards, right? You have to just, continue to work those credits up. And you need to, what's the word I'm looking for? Constantly asking. And again, it's the same thing with the banks asking for money in January and February when you're cash heavy, and pay off all your credit cards and apply for new cards, and you'll ask for credit increases, because again, you wait until you need it, they're not going to do it. But if you do it early on, when you've just, you had a killer Q4 and you've paid off everything quickly and stuff, you're better chance of getting your credit cards up to where it is. And really, I mean, as I said, I mean, it was a legit, 20 hours a week for a while, like dealing with trying to get credit to where I needed, because again, especially from our business, we do so much in Q4. I need that capital in, September and October, so I can, buy up that inventory to be able to finish it in Q4.
That right there is some like serious game for the person that's like super credit strapped. The time in which you apply is very, very important. You have to think about what's showing up on that credit profile. Yeah. I got denied for the Capital One Spark with like an 800 credit score time and time again. I apply for it right after Q4.
Yeah.
After the credit cards pay for, and we're good to go. And it doesn't seem to be a top.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, everything's timing. You have to be very strategic. So
And you got to know like which ones report to the personal, which one reports, because that Capital Spark one, until you get it over 150, I think they report the personal,
Yeah, they do.
it's a pain. But when you get, for what it's worth, that card's a great card.
It's a great card.
You just have to get it. Once you get, like, if you get your Amex, like, over 200 or 300K, then you can call an account manager with Capital One and say, look, I spend boatloads of money every month. Look at, here's my Amex card. I send you all the statements. Match that. And I'd rather put it on your card. But, 100%. And that's how we got our Capital One, up pretty big.
Yep.
That's some sauce right there.
100%. Well, and then the other element that's very like, maybe we should just re-highlight, is the unwillingness to take no for an answer, the repeated, like the stubbornness that goes into it.
Yeah.
You feel it. Like you're just not going to take no for an
answer. Yeah. No, you just, I was like, because I knew, like, I'm like, it's not like I have a business that's profitable. It's done well. I'm not asking for an insane amount related to our business revenues and profitability. What's wrong? Give me the damn money. So I find somebody eventually, but it was getting very frustrating. And yeah, it was pretty ironic and funny when it was the bank that was right down the street that I drove past every day. That was the one that finally gave me.
Yeah, the answer was right under your nose the whole time. But so pivoting a little bit into more of like the current operation, I mean, obviously money's a problem, getting that sort of capital. But what are the other struggles of managing a business of this size in the Amazon space for you?
I mean, it's always hard just dealing with different employees and personalities. I have a lot of great ones, but we also sometimes run into some challenges. It's just always something with Amazon. It's really just, it's just Amazon, right? Like you get something down and they're like, okay, now we're going to do inventory replacement fees. Or nope, now you, because back in the day, and I'm sure you guys have been long enough to see it, like you used to just build a shipment and it all went to one FC. Like it wasn't like, and so especially because when we started to pivot to trucks, to be able to, really reduce our, shipping cost, it was great. We knew that everything was going to go to our FC. Or really, it was a DC 20 miles from here. You get a truck for $300-$400. We just build it. And then next, it's, now you might get, And it really not that it goes that far, but it doesn't have to go that far. You know, 20 miles to 200 miles, it does increase the cost. And also, like, you know, when we do our truck loads, it's lots of times we'll do 5 shipments and we'll like put them together, you know, to fill up a full truck. But then it's one truck's going to this FC, this one's that, you know, and then, you know, I mean, I literally have a whole, you know, we have a lot of US based employees, but we do have some virtual assistants as well. And I mean, we probably spend 20 hours a week just dealing with freaking account health issues, because it's just, you know, nonstop of like, you know, this inauthentic, this, you know, this thing's went restricted, this thing's went stranded, you know, it's just, it's nonstop. You know, I talked about the brand review that I had, you know, on Christmas Eve that following year, the same thing happened. You know, we're starting to minimize, you know, our Nike, you know, investment, but we still probably had 500,000 in Nike, and we got another one like middle of friggin' back to school. Like, you know, got another brand review where we, you know, went, you know, I think that one we're only down for 48 hours. And that was partly our fault, because we got like a 7-day warning and we didn't submit the documentation within that first 7 days. And that was a big like wake up call of like, nope, we're not doing this anymore. Yo, it happened like over a weekend, and I was like, nope, sorry, ops team, you guys are working on weekends. We can't we need to have a team staffed to deal with this stuff. And maybe it was only 48 hours. I forget what it was, but all I know is like, I don't know if we might have submitted something, got rejected, and all I know is I can't remember exactly what the deal was, but it was definitely something where, hey, we need to really stay on top of that. So like now we proactively collect everything for every order up front, and it's all organized by ACE. And so as soon as an account like performance issue comes, we've already put up the front end work to gather the documentation. And then it's just, you know, tweaking the verbiage when you even have to submit verbiage. I don't even think you really need much verbiage anymore. I think through the new system, you're uploading files and stuff.
Pretty much.
But
what are some tips? And let's stay on that tangent of account health for a second here, right? So something that's come up a lot more folks are being much more aware of Section 3s. They're much more aware of starting to pay attention to that. You have a massive operation, right? So you're having this on the day-to-day. This is part of just how you operate your business. What are some things that you're seeing other than just staying on top of as soon as an account health issue comes up? Are there any tricks that you've learned, any things that you've adapted to over the years that you said, you know what, this is how I manage account health related issues?
Yeah. I mean, one thing, just staying on top of it, don't let it slip is key, right? Like there's so much going on, especially as you're sort of a one man shop or two man shop, two woman shop, whatever, you know, it's easy to say, there's this big sale, I got to hit it, I'll hit this in 48 hours. So, you know, if you don't have the team to do it, you need to take a pause, because, you know, next, you know, it's inauthentic or suspension, or not, sorry, the inauthentic turns into a Section 3 or a suspension. So, you know, being on it right away. Yeah, the big thing, and I've talked to a few people recently that like, I can't get, you know, this cleared. I'm like, what are you sending? They're like, well, I'm sending order confirmations. I'm like, yeah, they don't take order confirmations anymore. Like, you have to provide proof of delivery, you know, now to get cleared on inauthentics and Section 3s and suspensions. Like, you can't just say, hey, I ordered this from, you know, Nike.com and here's my order confirmation. You have to show the email that it was delivered to you. And, you know, you also need to just, you know, for us, there's added levels of complication, and other people may deal with it too, but, you know, we have multiple, you know, we have a warehouse, a prep center. At times we had, you know, in COVID, we had like 6 prep centers because it was just, you know, everybody was limited resources. So we spread it out. We always had to explain like, well, this one ASIN, why do I have 5 different buyers at 3 different addresses? So we always made sure to have documentation set up of explaining the relationship of like the different warehouses, you know, when possible. Sometimes it's not possible because it's like, you know, 300 credit card charges, but where possible, utilizing a credit card, you know, statement to reference like, look here, yes, this was bought by, you know, Nick, but it's not Jeff, it's not the company name, but here Nick is on our payroll. Here's our payroll report that shows that Nick's on it. Here's the credit card statement that, you know, shows that it's Nick is an authorized user, and sort of just having those all mapped up. Oh, by the way, the same credit card is on our Amazon account, and just trying to have that all explained clear as possible And again, we try to have it sort of as much pre-prepped as possible, because it's, you want to attack these things right away versus letting it sit.
So with, I think this is important for like the new seller, like you're becoming quite the storyteller when it's this complex. Are there any best practices that you've established when trying to tell these, like explain everything to Amazon? Basically, like, here's my business. Like, have you developed any best practices around that?
No, not really.
Fair enough.
Nope, I've just been talking about Amazon for 9 years now. So
okay. So you're just gonna submit the paperwork. We're not getting on the phone with them. We're just gonna submit and just
From that perspective, I got what you're saying. Yeah. So I have we have it all documented.
Yeah.
We redact our statements to, you know, like we'll highlight stuff like with like the ASIN, just try to make it as clear as possible.
Yeah.
We also, for what it's worth, we pay $100 a month to Seller Basics to have them in our back pocket, you know, when things, you know, if needed. I honestly don't know if we've ever really had to need them for inauthentics, but it's, they're good for, you know, the trademark complaints and the IP complaints and all that stuff, you know, or the threatening letters that everybody gets. Like, okay, what do I need to do? Is this one that's going to file an IP and I'm not going to be able to get removed? What's your experience? Just knowing that they're there to help in the event we do have some larger issues.
Jeff, I want to side tangent here for a second. So clearly a good communicator. You mentioned something early in the interview around 20,000 Facebook members. For most of the community right now, most folks aren't familiar with you. Why stop? Like, you've been in this game for a long time. You know the ropes. You have the education. You had a 20,000 member Facebook group. What is the social media now? And what are some of the things that you would like to do moving forward?
So, I mean, why I stopped? I mean, it was one of these things where it was just, as it relates to, you know, we built a large community and had, you know, a group. We had, you know, a paid, Amazon Flip group, you know, some affiliates and stuff, nothing, you know, we had a big group, but, you know, it wasn't, we were all going different ways. We weren't like not super active, but we had our paid group and we had some different stuff. From my perspective, it was time. I was like, I'm ready to step away from, you know, this. We had the real estate going, and in particular, COVID sort of changed a lot of things with us too, like from a family perspective, right? Like I have two kids, and COVID hit, and we're like, you know, we homeschooled them, you know, the COVID year, you know, 2020, 2021, you know, school year. And we lived up in Vermont where we had our rental properties, and we skied all the time.
Ooh.
And it was like, oh shit, they're gonna go back to school. I can't go live up in Vermont anymore. I'm like, you know, like, because I'm like, we're not built for like homeschooling our kids like year round. And really, I shouldn't say we. I'm not built to do anything. My wife does it all. I'm dealing with the business, and it's just, you know, it's not for us, right? So, that year going into after the COVID year, when the kids started to go back, we decided that we're going to pull the kids out of school January through March, and we're going to live in Vermont and ski every day. So it just, you know, I really was trying to, like, you know, utilize my time freedom, right? Like, yes, I still work a lot, but hey, I want to go and spend time with the kids, spend time with the family, and hell, I want to ski myself anyway. So it was just, you know, it was just getting to be too much to try to do it all. So I was like, something needs to give. So that's why I moved on from that. Right. You know, and at that point, again, I was closing every property. You know, again, if you close the house, it's a friggin' nightmare. Well, try doing 10 of them in, you know, an 18 month period or whatever. It was just insane. And so I was like, I just can't keep doing this. So I moved on from that. And then I, you know, stepped away for a while, and, you know, yeah, I was like, hey, it's time to get back. And, you know, I'd met Joe, and also, like, yeah, you know, it was time to figure out, like, I knew all these, I didn't know where they were all coming from, but there's all these new sellers and everybody's figuring it out. And I'm like, I'm missing something, right? Like, all these old guys, like all the people that I used to hang out with 9 years ago, like, you know, talking on Facebook Messenger and Facebook, they're all like doing something completely different. You know, there's not many of us still standing, right? So I'm like, I need to like figure out where there's other better people to network with. And I'm, you know, so that's where, which is, you know, me and Nick were in a Q4 group, you know, and with Discord, which might have, I don't know if that was my first introduction to Discord, but I was just starting to like, you know, there's got to be other places to network and, you know, meet with, you know, other sellers. And because I'm not stupid, I need to keep up with you young guys. Like, you know, if I just keep sitting there on Facebook trying to keep up with the new tricks, I'm going to be left behind. So, like, I got to get in here and try to, you know, figure out, you know, some of these tricks that you guys are have up your sleeves to keep my buy cost competitive with you guys.
So yeah, I mean, it's been great having you in Money Twitter. I remember the first like time you responded to something, like I wasn't familiar with you because you were living over in Facebook, but you've added a lot of value to the timeline very quickly. And I think that people will recognize that relatively quickly, that you're a great source of information. Kind of as we wrap up, I always like to give this as a kind of an open forum at the end. Is there anything that's like happening in the community that you think should be talked about or, you know, touched on?
I mean, I don't know if there's anything. I mean, the one thing I would just caution any new sellers or anybody listening is make sure you know your damn numbers. You know, there's a big push to get into Nike. And there's a lot of money to be made in Nike, but there's a lot of friggin' returns in, you know, customer, you know, in shoes. And I feel like that's not talked about enough. And I mean, I don't know about you guys, but like we sit at like 20-25% on returns on shoes. And, you know, I was actually, you know, had a, you know, a live on our a group, and I was saying, hey, I don't usually buy shoes with under a $20 profit. And I think everybody was like shocked. Like, well, why wouldn't you buy a $10 profit shoe? Well, when 25% of them are going to be returned, you know, and then you're going to have, you lose your FBA fee. You got to pay the return. I forget what is it, return? I forget what they call it, but the return penalty fee, like $5 to get a shoe shipped back to you. Like there's just, you can't make money on $10 profit shoes. Like, especially if the $10 profit shoe you purchase ends up being $5 profit shoe. So, you know, I would just say caution, you know your numbers, understand the true cost of returns, especially if you're selling in those category, because I mean, same thing with clothing. I mean, clothing's not as bad, but you're still sitting at 10-15%, you know,
right,
return rate, you know. So you definitely want to know what your returns are doing to your business, because it's an easy way. I've seen plenty of people that are like, I'm not making any money. I don't understand. I'm selling at a profit. And like, you're selling at a profit, but what happens when all those returns, you know, kick in if you're 100% shoes? You know, that 25%, you know, can wipe off. You really need to be at, you know, 40% ROI, 30% ROI to survive all the returns.
Well, there's probably an argument there to build slow, like you did, and just like progress. Like, okay, I've got this shoe. Let's see how it works. And so you're just really in tune to it, rather than just shotgunning and doing a ton of different things, and you just can't hang on.
Yeah,
you're learning too much.
Yeah, and it's good, and I've been bad at this too, but just you. And the thing is, the returns for shoes, they're not bad. In fact, you don't get a lot of damaged shoes, but it's still so painful from the, you know, the cost of business, because you lose that FBA fee that you paid. Yeah. You pay the return fee. Yeah. You pay, you know, a lot of them still sellable, but a lot of them also come back to you, and then you got to ship it back, and then you got to have a process to get rid of your death pile. Admittedly, that's something I've avoided for a long time, many times. My first warehouse, eventually, I just, you know, it probably was taking up 25% of my business or space, was a death pile. And I said, okay, well, my answer is rent a storage unit. So I just rented a storage unit, rented a truck, and just transferred all my stuff in there, so I didn't have to see it anymore. Not a good way to handle the death pile. But it freed up space so I could get stuff to minimize the times I had to prep outside because we ran out of space. But it's definitely, you know your numbers, know the returns, you know, go slow. There is a lot of people, and there's a lot of noise on new media here of, you know, people doing insane things pretty quick, which is awesome. Yeah. But don't feel like you need to go from zero to 100K in a few months. Like,
no,
figure out your numbers and, you know, build it. You know, or at least talk to those people that are doing it, because I don't know how they're doing it. It took me a long time to get there.
There's a lot of info out there. And I mean, I have a similar process with the death pile. I just wait for my wife to yell at me when we start to chip at it.
Yeah, you got to do something with it. So, So,
Jeff, there's a central theme, and I want to anchor this for the rest of the conversation here, right? So, a couple things that you've hit on, and I think it's a theme of anyone that's successful in this business. There's an aspect, and you clearly communicated it, that you just took raw action on things. Like, you went through and you're like, hey, I'm not taking a no for an answer. I'm going to find a way to be able to get it done. I'm not going to have every answer along the way, but I will get there. And I think that's something that resonates as we look across the community. People that are very successful, they have that same common trait. And for the audience, like, that's something to resonate with. Like, Jeff has clearly done this for 9 years and figured out a way to do it. So it's been a pleasure having you on the pod with us today. Where can people learn more from you, and where are you at on socials?
Yeah, I guess one thing I got to learn is, I guess instead of putting Jeff, I got to put my Twitter handle here. Yeah, so I've been hanging out on Twitter. It's Jeff Sends It. And then we have, Discord, Facebook, not Facebook. Well, I guess we do have Facebook, but Discord and YouTube is FBA Basecamp.
Nice.
And yeah. I think I have an Instagram. Haven't really figured that one out yet. I've been just hanging out on Twitter.
I haven't either.
Only but surely, you know, many years of Facebook. So Discord and Twitter has been enough for me to try to figure out in a short period of time.
Yeah, right. You can only do so much.
Yeah. But Jeff, I have to start training my, somebody teach me to do Discord and I'll show you how to source.
Oh.
I mean, Instagram.
Yeah, flood your DMs. But Jeff, yeah, thanks for coming on. It was a great pod. Into the audience. We'll see you next time.
Yeah.